Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, May 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Hillary Clinton talks about why she thinks she lost the presidential election.
The evidence for that intervening event is, I think, compelling, persuasive.
Another attempt at replacing Obamacare looks likely to fail. Congress gives airline executives a warning about recent incidents, and a 97-year-old says his harmonica has been the key to a long life. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, it's been a promise that President Trump and Republicans have been hoping to keep: repeal and replace former President Barack Obama's signature legislation, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. But so far, they haven't been able to do it, and it appears that their latest attempt will again come up short of votes needed in Congress. Joining me now for some understanding of what's happening with all of it is University of Richmond Professor of Healthcare Studies, Rick Mays. Thank you for being with us, sir. What is different about this latest plan that Republicans are putting forward?
The difference this time is that their new proposal, which is basically the same act with a small tweak, and that tweak is they want to allow states to get waivers for insurance that allow insurance companies to exclude people again, like we used to do, if they have a pre-existing condition.
Why do you think that, once again, they're having trouble getting votes?
The whole notion of rolling back the clock and going back to the pre-Obamacare world where people with pre-existing conditions could be excluded is so horrible now. I mean, we've turned a corner, and that's just not going to be politically or socially acceptable anymore. And I think the Republicans are now showing that. It wasn't clear that that was the case, but their new tweak to allow insurance companies to go back to excluding people with pre-existing conditions was meant to try to make insurance more affordable and to make concessions to the really conservative Freedom Caucus. And they were going to have ways they were going to try to account for people with pre-existing conditions. But this approach is extremely unpopular to the general public.
Right, and it would appear that the public's really speaking out loud and clear at many of these town halls where they're giving lawmakers an earful about how they feel about possibly losing their health care.
Yeah,
so that must have an influence.
You have 20 million new people who picked up insurance in the last 4 years. A lot of them used to have problems getting insurance. A lot of them could never get insurance before Obamacare. And they have time, and they're motivated to show up at these town hall meetings because they're directly impacted by this proposal. They could go back to being excluded. So no one has more motivation than they do to show up and to voice their concerns very loudly, and the television cameras love that, and journalists in general find that very riveting. So they're getting a lot of attention, and it looks really bad to be considered in opposition to these people or to be making their lives more difficult.
What do you think is the driving factor that has continued to make the issue of health care such a polarizing thing in this country?
Well, it was polarized before President Trump won office. If you look at opinion polls of what should be done about health care in the United States, it's for many years now, it's been pretty evenly divided. Half the U.S. population thinks the government should do more to provide and safeguard health care access, and half says the government should be doing less than it's doing now, and it should roll back more of its involvement and let the free market. So this is not unique to this period right now. This polarization has been around for some time.
Do you foresee Obamacare getting overturned?
I don't think it's going to happen. I think they had a shot. It wasn't a very good shot. Between January and March, I think that was their window. If they really had something legitimate, even if it was very different than the Affordable Care Act, if they had something that was legitimate and thought out and tested and would keep people covered who would gain coverage, I think they could have done it. I think what's been exposed in this whole process is that they just didn't have anything. They were really good on the rhetoric, and they were very good in opposition, and they were very good at highlighting the weaknesses and shortcomings of the Affordable Care Act, but they really didn't have anything to replace it with.
Do you think the whole reason that Donald Trump and Republicans are so committed to repealing Obamacare is because it was created by a Democratic president, or do you think it's because the whole concept of the government providing health care is just so unappealing to them?
You know, it's really hard to say at this point what's them, because if you look at the history of the Affordable Care Act and where it was originated and who pioneered it, it came out of the Heritage Foundation in the late 1980s and early 1990s as a position paper, and it was piloted in Massachusetts with Republican Governor Mitt Romney and Democrats there. And so it's a pretty bipartisan, pragmatic plan. So I can't imagine their genuine opposition to it is that it's a government-run anything, because it's a government expansion of Medicaid with a government support of private insurance. I think at this point, they have been telling their base for so long that they were going to do this, they just feel almost morally obligated to try. And on top of that, I do think Trump, in particular, is motivated to try to do some kind of health care reform that generates budgetary savings so that he can use those savings for tax cuts. That's more his passion. And I would say even for many of the Republicans in Congress, they're not passionate about health care. That's never been a passion of the Republican Party. What they are passionate about are tax cuts, and they need budgetary savings from some other part of the federal government's budget to give more tax cuts. And so I think one of their big motivations, and they can't say this publicly because it seems distasteful to say you're trying to do health care reform to generate budgetary savings for tax cuts, but I think that's number two on the docket, is once they get done with health care, to take those savings and apply the tax cuts. The problem is they can't get their health care reform proposal passed.
That's University of Richmond Professor of Healthcare Studies Rick Mays. Thanks for being with us. Well, turning now to the latest on what's trending on social media, we are joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what are people talking about today?
So everybody today is talking about Jimmy Kimmel. He's, of course, known as a comedian. He has his own late-night show on U.S. television. But on Monday night, he took a turn for the serious in his opening monologue. Now, Jimmy Kimmel and his wife had a newborn son, Billy, back on April 21st, and a few hours after Billy was born, it was discovered he had a heart defect and had to have surgery. So Jimmy Kimmel described this in his monologue to his audience last night, at some points breaking up, and you could really hear the emotion in his voice as he recounted this story.
Wow, let's take a listen to a little bit of it.
No parent should ever have to decide if they can afford to save their child's life. It just shouldn't happen. Not here. So, anyway.
Well, I can see why people are saying that was really gut-wrenching, really struck a chord with a lot of people, huh?
Especially for somebody who's usually so funny as a comedian to be talking about something so serious and getting so emotional. It really resonated with people. A lot of tributes pouring in from celebrities and from fans, and a lot of people thanking him, because one of the things he talked about in the monologue, he said, if your baby is going to die and it doesn't have to, it shouldn't matter how much money you make. I think that's something, whether you're Republican or Democrat or something else, we all agree on that. Talking, of course, about affordability of health care. He said that part of the reason why he was able to get the surgery for his son and treat his son, even though he had a pre-existing condition, was because of the health care laws in place. So a lot of people praising him for bringing that up as well. Now, Kimmel responded to that with a tweet of his own. He said, on behalf of my family, thank you for the lovely and loving tweets about our son, Billy, and also posting a picture of his wife and daughter saying that Billy is at home with them. His daughter, Jane, is playing Dr. Jane, aww, and she has a little toy stethoscope listening to Billy's heart. And for somebody like Jimmy Kimmel, he's someone who lives his life in the public eye, but not so much his personal life.
Right.
You don't hear a lot about his family. You hear more about his opinions on things, his jokes on things. But for him to talk about something so serious and so close to him really did resonate with a lot of his fans.
Absolutely. Anything else trending?
Yes. So we talked about yesterday Facebook getting in some trouble for monitoring teen social media posts and trying to find instances where they were unhappy or feeling stressed or unliked, and potentially trying to exploit that. Well, Facebook's in a bit of trouble again today with a different story.
Really?
According to the Wall Street Journal, a Facebook engineer examined codes submitted to the company by female and male engineers and found that female code submitted by female engineers was rejected more often than that of males. And not just rejected more, it was questioned more, it was focused on more for editing, that kind of thing. So this engineer is alleging discrepancy and sexism as part of Facebook's engineering group. Now, Facebook has come out with a statement saying it's incomplete and inaccurate. It's not the gender for the reason for the discrepancy, but the seniority of the employee. Now, a lot of people point out that is a problem in and of itself. That means there are fewer females who are senior employees than males. Facebook actually goes on to address this in this statement. They say, the discrepancy simply reaffirms a challenge we have previously highlighted. The current representation of senior female engineers both at Facebook and across the industry is nowhere near where it needs to be. So they are highlighting that there is a problem. Whether they do anything now to address it is another story. But this is a week, only 2 days, 3 days into the week. Facebook already has quite a few PR disasters they're having to deal with. Now, that being said, we have seen when Facebook has faced these issues in the past, they have actually stepped up and tried to change things. So we'll have to monitor this and see. But I would be willing to suspect they will actually do something to try to promote more women in engineering, in tech jobs at Facebook, and try to increase their seniority and give them more senior positions.
All right, Andrew, we appreciate it as always. Thanks so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. House passes a bipartisan effort to strengthen North Korea sanctions. The Justice Department defends its record against hate crimes. A mystery illness kills 12 in Liberia. And low-dose aspirin might reduce the risk of the most common breast cancer. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, Hillary Clinton offering some comments about the election during the Women for Women International's annual luncheon in New York. The former presidential candidate said she's going through the painful process of reliving the 2016 contest while writing a book. In a question and answer with CNN's Christiane Amanpour, Clinton was asked if she takes any blame for her 2016 election loss.
I take absolute personal responsibility. I was the candidate. I was the person who was on the ballot, and I am very aware of, you know, the challenges, the problems, the, you know, shortfalls that we had.
But Clinton says she does believe there were other factors.
I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of people who were inclined to vote for me but got scared off. And the evidence for that intervening event is, I think, compelling, persuasive.
Well, she reminded the enthusiastic audience, packed with women, that she did ultimately earn 3 million more votes than President Donald Trump. My next guest is the director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University, Jennifer Lawless. Thanks so much for being with us. So she did talk about the circumstances that led to her loss, but she also seemed to say that being a woman may have also contributed.
The two central reasons, I think, you know, that she mentioned had to do with the Comey letter so close to Election Day and Russia's intervention in the U.S. elections. She did mention, however, that she believes that misogyny played a role in the defeat and that it was one of many factors, but certainly that sexism is not dead. I think what's important to keep in mind here is that we are never going to know for sure whether the fact that Hillary Clinton was a woman kept her from getting elected. She was a unique candidate. She had an incredibly unique background. And until we can disentangle being a woman from being Hillary Clinton, we don't know what independent role sexism toward her factored into the election results. What we do know is that sexism and being explicitly sexist didn't cost Donald Trump the White House. And so in that way, I think that there is justification behind Hillary Clinton's claims, maybe not the way she intended them, but there doesn't seem to be any question that the American people were able to elect somebody. And the President of the United States right now is someone who has said things about women and who is engaged in behavior that we probably would have thought was not acceptable for somebody who would ultimately occupy the Oval Office.
Do you think that this country is just not quite ready to elect a woman?
I don't, and I don't think that that's the case for two reasons. The first is that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by more than 3 million. So the Hillary Clinton actually garnered more support overall than Donald Trump did. And if the American people weren't willing to or ready to elect a female president, the popular vote wouldn't have looked that way. The other reason that I don't think we should conclude that we're not ready to elect a woman is because when we look at all other levels of office, there no longer seems to be any kind of penalty for being a female candidate. Women win elections at equal rates as men. They raise just as much money when they run for office. Their media coverage generally looks the same. Now, obviously, the presidency is a little bit different, but the issue here is not that we were not supportive, that people weren't supporting Hillary Clinton because she was a woman. They weren't supporting Hillary Clinton for a variety of reasons. And until we have more female candidates run for president, it's impossible to know whether those reasons were real in and of themselves or whether they were sort of masking underlying sexism.
All right, that's Director of Women in Politics Institute at American University, Jennifer Lawless. Thanks for being with us. Well, U.S. lawmakers have put the nation's airlines on notice. Improve customer service or we'll make you do it. The House of Representatives Transportation Committee held a hearing for top airlines executives to testify and to determine how Congress might respond after a passenger was violently dragged off an overbooked United Airlines flight. Committee Chairman Bill Schuster had a stern warning for United CEO Oscar Munoz and other airline executives.
That should be the takeaway from today, is seize this opportunity, because if you don't, we're going to come and you're not going to like it.
Munoz also apologized repeatedly for the removal of Dr. David Dow, who last month refused to give up his seat to make room for airline employees. The video of airport police dragging Dow from his seat went viral.
It was a mistake of epic proportions in hindsight, clearly, and our policies broke down in that regard.
Munoz was joined at the hearing by United President Scott Kirby and executives from American Airlines, Southwest Airlines, and Alaska Airlines. United and others have announced policy changes now regarding overbooked flights. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A new study has found that engaging in a simple meditation exercise for 10 minutes a day can reduce symptoms in people with anxiety disorders. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Anxiety disorders are marked by repetitive, anxious, often baseless thoughts and fears about the future. Canadian researchers say 1 in 4 people will experience a disorder at some point in their lives. The thoughts are often obsessive and prevent anxious individuals from focusing on work and other activities. But engaging in a simple daily meditation exercise for 10 minutes, according to researchers at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, may help people keep their minds from wandering, improving their performance on tasks. The participants in a study conducted by Menggren Zhu and colleagues engaged in something called mindful meditation. Mindfulness is commonly defined as paying attention on purpose and staying in the present moment without judgment. Zhu is a clinical psychologist at Waterloo who led a study of people with symptoms of anxiety published in the journal Consciousness and Cognition.
We know that anxious people in general, if you ask them to stay on task, it's hard for them. They tend to worry. But those people who practice mindfulness, they didn't. They were able to stay on task.
In the study, 82 people with anxiety were asked to perform a computer task that required concentration. They were periodically interrupted, and the researchers gauged the volunteers' ability to stay focused. Half the group was then assigned to listen to an audiobook and the other half to engage in a mindful meditative activity, paying attention to their breathing, for approximately 10 minutes. Then they were reassessed using the computer. Zhu says there was a difference in performance between anxious people who did the mindfulness exercise and those who did not.
The anxious people who listened to audiobooks, they performed much worse over time. While the anxious people who practiced mindfulness meditation, they were able to, in a way, improve and maintain their performance on the task.
Researchers found the meditation, by increasing awareness of the present moment, reduced the frequency of repetitive, off-task thinking. In people with an anxiety disorder, learning to rein in repetitive thoughts with a simple 10-minute mind exercise may improve their productivity and even safety, so their minds do not wander while driving a car, for example. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Well, since the beginning of time, every generation has tried to find the secret to staying young, and one man might have discovered the key in something we can all do, no matter what our age. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti takes us on his musical journey and tells us how it can help anyone with breathing problems.
At Christmas time, we always had a stocking hung.
And when he was six, Jack Hopkins found a plastic harmonica in his. The next week, he shocked his dad.
He heard me playing popular tune of the day, Yes or She's My Baby, and it blew his mind.
Now, thousands of songs later, Jack jams at the Virginia Harmonica Fest. It's a gray-haired bunch who blow classic tunes. Jack founded the Capitol Harmonica Club a while back. He's outlived them all, except Frank Jameson.
I'm 84, so anyway, so it just, you know, I'll never catch up to Jack, but maybe that's okay.
That's the laugh of a man who just turned 97 years old. Jack credits his strong lungs to years of cradling a mean harmonica.
That's because it's the only popular instrument that requires an inhale and an exhale to make music. In harmonica terms, draw and blow, like this. Everybody ready?
So harmonicas are physical therapy for chronic pulmonary patients in Western Maryland. This group is called the Better Breathers. Kathy Middleton has been on oxygen for 7 years.
You know, as long as it closes up like this when you breathe, mine goes like this. And when you're blowing on that harmonica, I feel like I'm breathing better.
Jack says his harmonica helped him get better from a heart attack. Yep, that's him, making music in the hospital. For Jack, music is the tempo of life, played in the key of perpetual youth.
It's been a great life, and it ain't over yet.
Carolyn Pursuti. VOA News, Norfolk, Virginia.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars. expressing support for Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A stated objective of the United Nations Security Council is North Korea's abandonment of its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. For the past 20 years, well-intentioned diplomatic efforts to halt these programs have failed, noted U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in a speech before the Security Council. The threat is becoming increasingly real for Seoul, Tokyo, and ultimately the United States, he said. With each successive detonation and missile test, North Korea pushes Northeast Asia and the world closer to instability and broader conflict. For too long, the international community has been reactive in addressing North Korea. Those days must come to an end, said Secretary Tillerson. We have said this before, and it bears repeating. The policy of strategic patience is over. Additional patience will only mean acceptance of a nuclear North Korea. The time has come for all Security Council nations to put new pressure on North Korea to abandon its dangerous path, said Mr. Tillerson. I urge this council to act before North Korea does. Secretary Tillerson proposed three new actions to begin immediately. First, we call on UN member states to fully implement the commitments they have made regarding North Korea. This includes all measures required in Resolutions 2321 and 2270. Second, the U.S. calls on countries to suspend or downgrade diplomatic relations with North Korea. Constraining its diplomatic activity will cut off a flow of needed resources. Third, the Security Council members must levy new sanctions on North Korean entities and individuals supporting its weapons and missile programs, and tighten those that are already in place. Furthermore, Secretary Tillerson called on the international communities to suspend the flow of North Korean guest workers and to impose bans on North Korean imports, especially coal. China has an influential role to play, said Mr. Tillerson, as it accounts for 90% of North Korean trade. The U.S. looks forward to further actions that build on what China has already done. Lastly, all options for responding to future provocation must remain on the table. We much prefer a negotiated solution to this problem, said Mr. Tillerson, but we are committed to defending ourselves and our allies against North Korean aggression. It's time to implement a new strategy to denuclearize North Korea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.